This is the show where we invite three smart people to the studio for a conversation about the week's news or a big idea. Today, where the candidates, the campaigns, and the most critical voters are. Our roundtablers today, John Woodley is a public relations and communication strategist. He was, as you all remember, director of communications for Governor Jesse Ventura. Welcome back. Good to have you here, John.
Thanks, Carrie. I appreciate it.
Mike Zipko is founder of Zipko Strategy and a former Republican campaign staffer. Welcome. Do you admit that these days?
Yes, I do.
To your...
Although I've worked for Republicans, Democrats, and Independents, so
fair
sometimes
enough.
People wonder what box to put me into.
Yeah, you're the good point. Thanks. Good to have you here, Mike.
Thank you for having me.
And Javier Murillo is head of SEIU Local 26. What would you like to add to your title, Javier, that I didn't cover?
I am the co-host of a weekly podcast called Wrong About Everything.
Excellent. Are you wrong about everything?
The two Republicans on the podcast are wrong about everything.
All right. Are you wrong about which way this election is headed right now, do you think?
I think we're actually all on the podcast in agreement that it's kind of a disaster for the Republican Party at the moment.
So. And when you see 85 days out, does that shake your confidence a little or not?
It doesn't shake my confidence. It makes me think that we have a lot of work to do and we can't be complacent.
Democrats. Yeah. Why can't you be complacent when you think it's headed for disaster for Republicans?
Well, because things can change, you know. International events could happen, like things, something in the economy. There are lots of things that can introduce unknowables into a race, and you have to be ready for that. I think also on my side of the aisle, we're also trying to take advantage of that if it turns out to be the disaster that it's looking like right now, of making sure that congressional and Senate races are benefited on that Democrats are elected.
Mike, is this looking like a disaster to you for the Republicans?
At a presidential level, you would have to say so, because it makes people wonder who is in charge of the party, what is the party about? But then also you have to kind of wonder, where does it go when you get to Minnesota? Because Trump is in his own brand above and beyond. You know, a lot of Republicans will say Trump is not a Republican. So you wonder, with Minnesota legislative races and things like that, what does it do? You know, and how does that translate down? And also, here's the other great thing. Every prediction related to this race, specifically more on the Republican side, has been wrong
exactly.
All the way through.
It's
been a very hard thing to pick. And also understanding that this is such a non-traditional campaign path or cycle, it's hard to really know. And there's that reality showness to what goes on that makes you kind of wonder what could be next. With WikiLeaks and everything else, it's just it's almost like it's a campaign brought to you by Bravo.
John, I mean, Mike's point about the unpredictability of this race and how the pundits have been wrong all the way along when it comes to the GOP, how do you take that in as you think about where this race is headed? The presidential race specifically.
Well, I think we should be cautious because and when I say we, I mean, I'm obviously a Hillary Clinton supporter, and I anticipate that she will win and will win easily. But
why are you an obviously Hillary Clinton supporter? Because you have been an independent. You could be supporting Gary Johnson. Why aren't you?
Because I believe in Hillary. I believe in Hillary, and I believe in her policies, and I've always been a Clinton guy. I ran the Clinton campaign in Minnesota in '92, and was appointed by Clinton. And so there's some sort of loyalty there, I think, that remains. Do I think that she's the perfect candidate? Do I think that she would be winning by 8 points now if there was someone from the Republican side that had more stature and integrity than Trump? Probably not. She'd probably be in a very tight race, but still, I think she's the best choice, no question about it.
Yeah, I think that in terms of the volatility of the race, right, that I was listening to Nate Silver's podcast, and they were answering the question, how did they get Trump so wrong in the primaries? And what they were saying was that actually, when they looked back at all the numbers, that that it was there. That it was there to be seen that the polling did not turn out to be – that actually the polling turned out to be correct. It was the pundits not believing the polling that was incorrect, that the polls consistently showed that Republican voters preferred preferred Trump, and everyone assumed that, look at past histories, a novelty candidate like that would flame out, but that now when you go back and look at it, actually it was actually fairly predictive. And I do think that the mistake that Trump has made is to assume that he could do the same thing in a general election that he could do in a Republican primary.
You know, that's something that I wanted to bring up, is his strategy does not seem to be individual states putting together organizations. It seems to be kind of this overall, as you said, primary strategy. You win or lose a national election in individual states, don't you, Mike?
You know, it's targeting voters at a general election. Primary is very different. But I think if you go right now, I almost think that Trump is his own red herring away from what it was that drove the Republican Party base to support somebody like him. Well, if you look at some, there were some focus groups done in New Hampshire in early January. And if you listen to those focus groups, they sounded tremendously a lot like why people supported Jesse Ventura in Minnesota years ago, because they were frustrated with the establishment and what's happened with all of the stuff that Trump has done lately from the kind of these ongoing distractions. It's taken away from the fact, if there was not energy at the grassroots to say, I'm not satisfied with what we have as our leadership right now, they wouldn't have supported Trump. They supported Trump because he was not part of the establishment. What's gotten lost now is going after, you know, Gold Star families and everything else. It's kind of distracted from that. The dissatisfaction, the frustration, and it was also on the Democratic side as well, too.
Absolutely.
I mean, you could have heard some people say if it was Paul Wellstone instead of Bernie Sanders, Paul Wellstone might have given Hillary a better run because he would have been even a better candidate at bringing that dissatisfaction and that conversation into the mix. But there's a reason why Trump got there, and it's everyone kept thinking, well, those people aren't really that upset. They'll never stick with Trump. And the more you wag your finger at people saying, don't support him, he's not good enough, it's the people who they don't like telling him not to do something, the response back is, I'm going to vote for Trump twice as hard.
So the Jesse Ventura comparison there, John, do
None.
You see it?
No comparison.
How so?
No comparison. Well, first of all, Jesse Ventura has integrity.
Well, I mean,
why don't you explain?
I mean, look, you know, I mean, in the long term, I think Jesse had integrity as leader of a third party. But when he went in office, it became more about Jesse's person. Jesse didn't do much to build a third
Jesse
party.
Jesse Ventura
in Minnesota.
Did no harm. Do you think you can compare that to what Trump might do as president? I don't think so. Jesse Ventura did good. He put together a team, and notwithstanding present person here, a very good team. And they legislated well. They worked well with Democrats and Republicans. Toward the end, did he do something maybe similar to what Trump is doing now? He went after the media, which was a huge distraction and caused problems for him in the last 18 months, 2 years. But still, no comparison. Jesse Ventura is not a bigot. He's not sexist. He is a man of integrity and honor. And you may not agree with him, and you may not agree with his communication style, but he is no Donald Trump. He is light years above him.
Mike?
My point was more about the people who supported Jesse because he was not Skip Humphrey and he was not Norm Coleman.
Well,
But my point about that was they picked somebody and they went to him with an emotional connection from a populistic energy. And there was populistic energy early on with Trump. Right now, it has gone so far away from that. I think the reason Trump won the primary was because of that same sort of energy. And I'm not saying that Jesse Ventura and Donald Trump are the same person at all, but the energy that drove both of them to win is very similar.
Well, I like that clarification. Let me tell you this, though. You talk about the Republican base and how Trump has organized them and enabled them to support him. It's because of an issue that I think probably, if he would concentrate on more, would get him a broader base. And that is globalism versus Americanism. Joel Klein did a piece in Time this week that sort of dissected his Trump's economic speech in Detroit and said if he would go out and start campaigning about Americanism and using the line he used in the speech that went something like, we want American steel in the spine of this country. If he would do that, look out, Hillary.
But the foundation that those statements are based on, there's just no economic foundation for that.
Well,
I'm bringing back jobs to American steel. Where's the actual?
Let me ask if I can ask Javier to comment on this. I'd be very interested. Now there are a lot of my generation union members that are in support of Donald Trump, and maybe in not supporting or not crazy about Hillary.
Yeah.
And that appeals to them. But I would be interested in Javier's
Javier?
Observation.
Yeah. What do you say?
Well, I mean, I think that there's a lot of the political class talks about sort of the Reagan Democrats as, you know, the people who Reagan flipped along those lines of union members, things like that. The problem is that there aren't many of those left. They became permanent Republicans. They are the Republican base now. I think that a lot of the way that labor has changed, right, that where the fastest growing unions are service sector and a lot more diverse. The question of where labor stands is just it's a different one. I do think that the challenge that Trump has, although he has had in the primary certainly rhetoric about trade, that might appeal to folks. There's so many things about his biography and you know how he does business himself that contradicts that it's not an easy message for him to land. It's just it becomes as simple as Hillary Clinton holding up a Donald Trump made shirt and saying this is made in China. It's a very simple argument.
But I want to come back to it's a simple argument to make because you obscure the actual reality of the numbers too. Trump's plan, and we broke down the economic plan, I think last week, for holding companies accountable if they build manufacturing plants overseas. He's going to fine them. Our guest said there's just no mechanism for forcing American companies to build manufacturing plants here, and there's really not much of a mechanism for bringing manufacturing jobs back into the United States.
Does that matter?
So you're saying it sounds good on the
well,
on the
Bernie well, Sanders went around the country,
I,
you know,
agreed.
Selling
I know,
pie
I get
and
it.
Free college
and anything you want,
absolutely,
you know?
Right.
And there was no mechanism. There
right.
was no way
Sanders
it was going to happen.
Sanders didn't end up as the nominee, though, so I think it's worth putting a reality check
but
up against what he's saying.
He got a lot closer than people would have thought at the beginning of the campaign.
Yes, but you see my yeah. argument here is right. let's really – what's it all based on, this whole Americanism versus globalism
Based on the
emotion.
The emotional attachment to that group, that segment of society that is so frustrated that they're no longer live in a society that was theirs, that was American, that was, you know, jobs at Hormel that could get you a cabin on the river or up north, whatever. It's gone. It's over with. And they dream about it being back, and he's talking to them about it. That's what it's all about.
Yeah, but I mean, I think it's important to note, though, too, that group of folks that we're talking about now, that this is a racialized conversation that's happening, that he is directly appealing to white working class people and white people generally feeling disaffected. The country's not like it is. I think where the problem Republicans have is this is a monster of their own creation. I think a lot of conservatives are actually acknowledging that and thinking. And I think there's an interesting reckoning happening in the party on this question of like that for so many years, so many election cycles, there was an appeal to dividing people along race. And this it turns out, is the end result where all subtlety is lost. Where it is directly appealing to white people. You have white supremacists supporting Donald Trump. He's speaking to folks directly, and he's so overtly offensive to people of color that what used to be kind of a subtext, what used to be dog whistles, are now just out in the open.
Mike, what would you say?
There's a definite connection to there's an exploitation of fear, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of the fear of people who are feeling like they're losing, that are being disconnected. And the other point Javier makes, I agree with, that there's this, the Republican Party has a long-term problem that they're being viewed by other races as being not friendly, when ironically, you look at the Republican Party supports things like school choice and ways to improve education achievement that you would think would be more appealing to communities of color where you have a higher level of achievement gap. Look at Minnesota alone. But there is not a consistent, smart way for the Republican Party to make inroads into that space because they end up almost with a circular firing squad taking themselves out in the process.
I'm arguing on behalf of Donald Trump. I want to say that.
That's
good
how
Lord
I heard
not.
It. Yeah, no.
I mean, I would have to say the one thing that I think is interesting is the leadership of the Republican Party and the way they are treating Trump is really disappointing to me.
Are you talking about Priebus, the RNC chair? Or
Priebus,
do you mean
the speaker?
Yeah. Okay.
I mean. Back in 1996, 7, 8, whenever it was, I mean, this is the party that was impeaching President Clinton for sexual improprieties, and now they're endorsing this guy. this Trump guy who admits that he has sexual affairs and has admitted them through his life. I don't understand it.
That seems to be the least of their problems for me. I mean, well, I think they're worried about a whole lot of other stuff besides what he does in his personal life.
And they're worried about it, but they're behind him.
But there's also a fear if you see grassroots support for a candidate and you get on the wrong side of that grassroots energy that you're going to need every piece of that to win an election. You're in a really tough place because on one side is a person who is offensive, who is saying things basically whenever it comes into his head, he says. Yet on the other hand, there's a group of people who are connected to him and view him as an important voice. And if you alienate them, you lose your shot at any kind of leadership that you have in terms of winning an election. And the fear of losing elections forces people to do really interesting things.
I think, you know, Mike, that is, and there's been discussion about this. I know you saw this a couple months ago about kind of the cravenness of standing someone like Paul Ryan, of standing next to Trump when he says some of the most offensive things, but still standing next to him and saying, I don't like it, but I'm still supporting. I mean, you know, the message that sends to already disaffected and cynical voters is just anything for politics and power.
Yet on the other hand, if you had a candidate with Hillary Clinton who had a higher level of believability, this thing would be long over. But what's interesting, as the Trump's numbers have gone down, it's not that Hillary's picking up voters. People are just moving away from Trump. Her numbers are not going up.
I mean, that's exactly why there should be some caution. I mean, an 8-point lead is not a big deal. It's been done before, and it could be done again.
Javier?
I doubt it, but it could.
Yeah. I mean, I was always of the opinion, I think, that Republicans had always underestimated Hillary Clinton as a candidate. She has a lot of strengths. Obviously, there are a lot of challenges. You know, an interesting thing happens with her numbers, which you look at her career. When she has a job, her numbers are very high. Her approval ratings when she – as Secretary of State, her approval ratings of the American public were extremely high. They were through the roof. When she's running for jobs, when she's asking for promotion, those numbers go down. And I think that has a lot to do with gender and how women in politics are perceived. But I think that right now, you know, she's an interesting thing is happening with this campaign that there were a lot of Democrats, especially like Bernie supporters, who assumed that she would swing to the middle or right. And she's not changed her message. She's been a very disciplined candidate. And I think they are, probably have her saying a lot less than they would in a normal, because all you have to do is like, I would tell her to be quiet.
I want to talk to you about that. I have to say this. You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. It's a conversation about politics, taking stock of some of what's happened just this past week in the presidential campaign, and then some of the larger themes that have emerged in the campaign. Mike Zipko with us, founder of Zipko Strategy. Javier Murillo with us, head of SEIU Local 26. And he does a podcast called Wrong About Everything.
Wrong About Everything.
I'll be listening. Mm-hmm. And John Woodley with us, a public relations and communication strategist. Back to you, Javier, on... So with an 8-point lead and the super cautiousness that we know the Clintons do everything with, her answers on this email controversy continue to be so puzzling. She's been asked about it 1,000 times. She can't seem to get the right answer. I don't get it. And because you're here to say, I support Hillary Clinton, I'm going to ask you, what is the problem?
I think that the problem from a campaign perspective is that they didn't early on settle on what this is what we're going to say, and this is and really, you know, just I advise candidates when an issue comes up, you know, you just like you got to come clean as soon as possible. And I think they were not clear early on just how big this would become, what it would look like. I actually think that, you know, the issue itself is actually not that huge of a
and
deal.
And she has magnified it by the inept way she talks about it.
No, that's absolutely right. I think that to me, the real issue with regards to the emails, you know, there was people forget there was a very similar scandal in the Bush administration on the way out with like people using private servers and Karl Rove deleting thousands of emails, things like that. That the what is when you look at the actual substance of the issue there, what's scandalous is how poor the U.S. government, the security measures in general, in terms of like just cyber, like use of cyber technology. She actually asked for the State Department for a secure phone, and But I think it adds to the confusion for her and her campaign about what to say, because they did not know what would become public.
But she surely knows now. She just gave another super inept answer to this.
Hillary is not Bill. Bill knew how to handle. It's interesting. He seemed to be better at dealing with these scandals. But this is not like other email scandals, because it's not just about the emails. It's a connection between her and the foundation. And it's also raising questions about, is there a rule for the Clintons and a rule for everybody else? And there's a reason why the general public has a low level of trust in her, and it's not being told that don't believe her. They've reached this position based on a series of these decisions. And if there is one good answer to why she did it, it's taken them this long to try and figure out what to say, and every time they talk about it, it's slightly different. And it is frustrating, and it's not like everything else, because when you start looking at what's the relationship between her and the foundation, and it brings you back to these things that the two of them did before, and Bill and Hillary. But I think part of the challenge is Hillary answering those questions is not as good as Bill. Bill was a better politician at dealing with this.
Well, and which I think she readily admits, right? Yeah. This is a thing. I think ultimately, right, when you look at the Clinton history, if you're Hillary Clinton becoming Secretary of State, you look at 20 years of being accused of murdering Vince Foster and every other thing like that. If you my guess is that there was an element of you shield as much from Freedom of Information Act requests. Like, that would be my guess.
John, but here's my question for you.
And that's let me just say that Hillary's problem is started at the very beginning when this was discovered. She didn't address it then honestly, and that's why she has a trust problem.
It's
too late now.
Yeah.
And it's every time she had to confront
she's
it again,
blown that,
she was evasive.
That's
she's
part
blown
of it.
It.
Yeah.
She blew it from the very beginning.
Here's my question for you, John, because all three of you actually managed candidates, but it is we're closing in, I think, on almost 300 days since she's held a press conference. I don't understand. She says, well, I do individual interviews and I do a podcast where they ask me a bunch of softball questions, that kind of thing. Honestly, would you tell a candidate like Hillary Clinton with some of the issues that we've just talked about? You're right. Don't take a bunch of questions from a bunch of reporters who are building on what the other reporters are asking. Avoid it at all costs. Or would you say, it looks like you've got something to fear here?
Well, I don't know if I can answer that question. I mean, you'd have to be there and understanding the dynamics of the campaign and the candidate better than I do. But my general rule is mix it up with the reporters. Mix it up. Show them that you can stand on your integrity. That's how you really, really gain respect and credibility.
She's done that in the past.
Is by doing it directly with reporters. Now, not everybody is going to agree with me on that. That's always been my philosophy. And some candidates are not as good at it as keep that in mind.
But on the other hand, you know, as much as you hate to see Hillary keep moving ahead by not talking to the media, show me where it's hurting her not doing these news conferences. Because the job of a candidate and the team around a person running for office is not to make the media happy, not to fill up your notebooks, and not to give you headlines and articles to click on.
Understood.
And guess what? By not doing that, there is no harm to her campaign. I mean, their level of trust is not going to change. If she does a news conference and mixes it up with the reporters, her level of trust is not going to go up. And if that's not a good place for her to be, and she's not going to do very well in an environment where you don't get to control that because it's chaos and it's stream live and it explodes to a higher level than before, then don't do it. I mean, it's tough to sit back and say, I wish she'd answer these questions. But if I was giving them advice, until it's hurting your polls, and right now it's not hurting her polls, I wouldn't do it.
Yeah, and I think that different candidates have different strengths. I would go so far as to say it would be political malpractice for someone advising Hillary Clinton to go mix it up with the press. That's not her forte.
Really?
That's not her forte.
Jeez.
But I think that's not everyone's forte. But you can.
I don't care if it's your forte or not. I think you have an obligation to answer questions from the media.
I think she does
more often than once every 300 days.
Well, I think she certainly does and will as president.
You can't be sure about that.
No.
You can predict that she's going to go into the presidency and she's going to suffer from the same credibility problems throughout because she doesn't address it. She doesn't go stand up for herself.
She doesn't stand up. She was 11 hours under like intense questioning from Republicans.
Well,
she did extremely
because
well.
Because she had to. Right. She was forced into that. And somebody should tell her that if you can do that with that committee, you can do it with the reporters.
I mean, she could, but why would you? Why would you?
For the credibility.
I'll tell you why she should do that. Because when you start to govern, if you don't have the people behind you with confidence and trusting you and have credibility, you're not going to get much passed. I mean, if she is not. And I appreciate what you said earlier, that she does often perform better in the eyes of the public when she's in office mm-hmm. or in a position than when she's campaigning. So let's be hopeful that that happens. And I'm in support of that happening. But I think part of that is being direct with the people. And the most easiest way to do that is with reporters asking you a question and doing it with integrity, with courage. And sometimes
Mike's not buying this
going
over here
back
at all.
Sometimes going back.
Why are you pointing at me?
It's the cynical safe play to not do it because this is the way the system has evolved and the political game has evolved. I mean, there is a way. Unfortunately, you get rewarded for not doing this, which I agree that it's, you know, to be able to sit there and say, here's what I think, here's what I believe is the right thing to do. But the smarter thing to do is to not do that. And the other part of what you just said, well, if she goes there, she's going to have a hard time getting anything done in Washington. I think the sad reality is I don't think anybody in our country expects much to happen in Washington at all either way. So she's going to go in there with an expectation of not much happening whoever wins. And that's too bad. But I think that's the reality we're dealing with.
I think
now.
It really is too bad because I think something should happen. And I'm hopeful that something does happen. And I think that if the rest of the country feels the way you do, that you don't expect anything to happen, then it's not going to happen.
He's just looking at past history.
I wish it wasn't true. It'd be great if something more were to happen. But it's really tough when you expect Congress to deal with issues. I mean, it's really rare. You know, now they joke an act of Congress is really a much more monumental thing than it's ever been before.
But when you look at her in the primary season, I think the tendency to be careful hurt her. Right. This whole thing, not having as many debates. Right. Once they actually got over that and then scheduled more debates, she does really well in debates. She's a policy wonk. And she up against, I think, the comparison then at that point when more people were paying attention, where Sanders would give the same speech and the same answer to almost any question. And her the nuance with which she could speak to almost anything she looks good as a candidate. And they learned that the hard way. I think like Sanders got a lot of momentum back when they were being careful. I think right now they are, you know, assessing and I would see no reason to do anything differently right now. I think there are debates coming up.
I want
Trump
to talk a little bit about
careful
the debate. John,
politicians get reelected. Careful politicians get reelected. Courageous politicians pass laws, get things done, and leave office.
I agree. And that's what we're missing now are people who want to be courageous and go in and do something of substance and significance. We don't have enough of that anymore.
I mean, this is something Ventura used to channel and talk about, right?
Well,
it's always looking ahead to the next election.
That's right.
And not being willing to lay some of that on the line.
That's
to
exactly
do what you
right.
think. Not to quote Jesse Ventura ever.
Hey, you wrote a book.
You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. It's a conversation about the campaigns, the candidates, the themes, and the news of the week, which is hard to keep up with here. We'll get a look at the latest news, and then we'll continue our conversation, including talking a bit about the upcoming debates. And I want to ask our panelists here about what it means when Donald Trump talks about a rigged election. What are the consequences of that for voters that I think we've already acknowledged are pretty cynical and dispirited in a lot of cases? So that's on the other side of news.
Good morning. I'm Phil Picardi in the NPR newsroom. Donald Trump has arrived in Baton Rouge to tour the flood-damaged city. Trump was joined by his running mate, Mike Pence. Democratic Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards says he is not involved in Trump's visit. Trump is expected to get a look at some of the neighborhoods devastated by flooding in Louisiana. Meanwhile, Trump's campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, has resigned in the wake of a campaign shakeup and revelations about Ukraine work. The Obama administration is facing a storm of criticism after acknowledging a $400 million cash payment to Iran 7 months ago was contingent on the release of a group of American prisoners. State Department spokesman John Kirby has said it was actually Iran's money the U.S. was returning, but the U.S. did withhold the cash delivery as leverage while the Americans were being held. Kirby told MSNBC the U.S. offers no apologies. Republicans have said the U.S. paid ransom for hostages, which goes against a long-held policy. U.S. Olympic swimmer Ryan Lochte is apologizing for his behavior and not being more careful or candid in how he described events. Lochte and three other swimmers ran into trouble in Rio after a night of drinking and vandalizing a gas station restroom. Lochte told a story about being robbed at gunpoint after the incident, but Brazilian police have given a different account. One of the swimmers reportedly agreed to pay more than $10,000 after questioning by authorities. One person is dead after two New Jersey transit buses collided in Newark this morning. The person killed was driving an empty bus that collided into another bus. A transit spokeswoman says the other bus was carrying about 20 passengers. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:37.
Later on All Things Considered, it's Friday, so our resident pundits process the week in politics, and then the Cube critics set your silver screen agenda. I'm Tom Kranitz. Our Friday pair of pairs and all the day's news. Join me on Minnesota Public Radio News starting at 3.
Programming is supported by the McKnight Foundation, driving sustainable solutions to help the Midwest be a leader in advancing a clean energy economy. Online at McKnight.org.
I'm Carrie Miller. You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. John Woodley, Mike Zipko, and Javier Murillo with us today. And I wanted to talk about what it means when Donald Trump talks about a rigged election. We had an in-depth conversation about it. Stuart Stevens was one of our guests. He ran the Romney campaign. And here's what he said about Trump and this idea of the rigged election.
It's incredibly irresponsible for any candidate president to be talking about this. But for a nominee to be talking about it goes, I think, beyond just sort of garden variety irresponsible. This is the kind of rhetoric that begins a drumbeat that kills democracy. First of all, it's gibberish. There's no logic behind what he's saying. There's no proof of it. There's no data point. It's the worst kind of fear-mongering and drum-beating that make people believe that their democracy isn't really a democracy.
It kills democracy, Mike. Is that too sensational?
I definitely think it plays on a cynicism, and it's also a way you hear people talk about, well, does Trump really want to win or not? And it's a great way to start laying bombs behind him that almost kind of gives him a reason. It's like setting up the loss that, by the way, here's why I'm going to lose, because the media and everybody else is going to steal this away from you. And what's also terrible is that as a hangover, it leaves this negativity into an electorate that says he didn't win because the other side did something dishonest, and it has nothing to do with whether or not he was the right candidate or not. And what it does is it carries forward this other cynicism and level of lack of trust in government and institutions at a time when we already have enough of that already. It builds on that. And it's another case of playing on fear. And it's a great thing to throw that out there because it can't be disproved. And it's this amorphous thing that just leads to this point of saying, yeah, you know what? It's right. It wasn't about Donald Trump saying 17 crazy things. It was because someone stole something from him.
Yeah.
And people will hang on to that.
I mean, Javier, it gets right to the credibility thing that John and Mike were talking about earlier.
Yeah. I mean, to me, One of the many surreal things about this election cycle is hearing things like, for example, the Republican you just played, hearing Republicans say things and thinking that's exactly correct. I completely agree with that. And Donald Trump, this is where I said earlier that I think there is a reckoning happening in the Republican Party. And the question is what the party will do after with that, because there are many people seeing, I think, and calling this what it is. I think it is absolutely dangerous rhetoric. When you combine that with the whole thing about whether he was joking or not about assassination,
the Second Amendment thing,
we can't have a president who might possibly be interpreted as talking about assassination. You know what I mean? Like, it's even the best interpretation of it was like, oh, well, I was misinterpreted is what was his line about it, which I don't think it was a misinterpretation at all. But even the best thing, like, you can't have a president who stands at a podium and says things like that and have the whole world say, oh, did he mean nuclear war? And so I think that you combine those things of people feeling maligned, of people feeling like wronged, that this was rigged, and while also seemingly inciting violence, it's a really dangerous recipe. And I would put it exactly like the gentleman that it endangers democracy. It's a cauldron, and it really scares me.
John, one of the things we did in that show was played Al Gore's concession speech 5 weeks after the Supreme Court had weighed in and 5 weeks after the election, I should say. And at that point, the Supreme Court had weighed in. And to listen back to that, I mean, you could hear Gore, the internal struggle of Gore not believing that it had been a totally fair election, but doing the thing he thought at the time was right for the country. The comparison there, night and day.
Well, I think you have to remember that when politicians sense that it's going down and they're not going to win, they generally go to it's not a fair process, and then they blame the media.
Right.
And we were talking about comparisons before to our current former governor and Trump. And you recall that, and this is just an observation, when Governor Ventura was beginning to become frustrated and not getting some of his initiatives passed, losing cooperation from the legislature, he then often turned to blaming the media and playing the Republicans and Democrats have it all rigged. He never used the word rigged, I don't think. But
this sounds familiar.
Yeah. And that's common. Yeah. That's very, very common in the political game.
And behind the scenes, your advice on, you know, yelling at the media and talking about how it's all wired against you is what to him?
Well, I advised him to lay off a little bit on the media. I didn't say stop it, because in some ways it can help. The media is not one of the most loved societies in this country. But my advice to Governor Ventura was basically not to go after the media. The Jackals thing, I do not believe, helped us in our effort to pass legislation.
Yeah.
So.
And it's hard. You also, when you're in a campaign and you're going to lose or you have lost, how you make the transition. If you go back to when Norm, Skip, and Jesse ran against each other, Norm was the first person to concede that night on election night. And Skip, even though finished third, Norm stepped
up. Skip Humphrey, we should say.
Humphrey. And, I was in the ballroom and it happened. And Norm stepped up and said, you know what? We lost. I just called. The election's over. Even though Skip was in third place. And it really helped Norm kind of say, you know what, I lost. We're moving on. And you kind of find some way to move forward. But it's really tempting to be able to blame everybody else because it's really hard in some situations. You've put so much heart and soul into something. And whether you're not, when you're not getting done what you want or the outcome is not what you want, because it's a job interview when you're campaigning in front of the entire community. And if you don't get it, it's really tough to stand up there and say, by the way, I wasn't good enough. No, it's got to be somebody else. And Trump just takes us to a really high level.
I was going to say, I just don't want to lose that this is – I do think this is different. I don't think this is like your run-of-the-mill politician looking like he's going to lose and looking for an excuse. I actually think this is incredibly dangerous for a major party candidate for president of the United States to be stoking those kind of fears while simultaneously seemingly joking about Second Amendment solutions – and having violence at his rallies, I think it is extremely dangerous. We see this in other countries. We see where it leads, and it's to nothing pretty.
I don't disagree with that at all, Javier. I completely agree with you because Donald Trump has taken it to a new level, and a level that is scary, and you are absolutely right. When I compared it to Jesse Ventura, I was simply stating sort of overview of of that tactic, and Jesse Ventura never did that.
Right. I want to ask you all about down ballot races, not some of the individual ones in Minnesota, but in general, how some of these candidates, Kelly Ayotte, Ron Johnson in Wisconsin, how some of these candidates manage having somebody like Trump at the top of the ticket, and what that balancing act is like.
It's confusing and scary because you have to decide where you're going to be, and you also need to find somebody to be consistent. But you're also, if you're a Republican running, and Ron Johnson needs grassroots support in Wisconsin to try and hold off Russ Feingold. But the problem is that grassroots energy has been more connected to Trump than anything else. How do you not alienate those people,
exactly,
but then say something to other folks saying, by the way, I'm not with him? There's a poll out today about the election right now in Virginia and around D.C. where there's more elective, more college educated voters. Trump is losing dramatically because when you start looking at college educated voting segments of the population, Trump loses by a lot. There's a lot of those people who are likely to vote for a Ron Johnson. But if Ron Johnson says, I'm with Trump to get the grassroots, you're going to lose a lot. lot of other voters who are maybe more moderate or middle right Republicans.
So if you're running in Virginia, you're looking at those numbers right around kind of on the outskirts of D.C., but you're also looking at the rest of Virginia and you're running statewide.
And you better figure it out. And the one thing that's going to save you is being consistent. If you look like you're changing back and forth, then you lose both sides.
Is this a political decision or is it about someone's personal integrity?
Well, that's what I was asking about Speaker Ryan.
There is no question in my mind that I respect the person that would look at a Trump candidacy and say, I cannot stand next to this man. My personal integrity will not let me do that. And that's what they should do, and that's what Ayotte's done.
But I think similar to what we were talking about before in terms of Secretary Clinton, I think that was something that they had to do early on because Trump hasn't changed as a candidate. And I think the corner that Kelly Ayotte is in and Ron Johnson and others is that they early on decided that the politically expedient thing to do was to not take on the grassroots. And now that it has gotten worse and other Republicans have started to fall, I think it's too late. I think Kelly Ayotte cannot suddenly say, well, I can't support him. I think just like Eric Paulson here, he can't suddenly say, I'm not going to vote.
I think Kelly Ayotte said this week that she... is going to vote for him.
They're looking for a way to slice this. The clean path out of a really muddy situation, and it just doesn't exist.
Well, the clean path out is to be honest and to say, I cannot vote for this man. He is dangerous to this country. And if I lose my election because of that decision, so be it.
I'm trying to think why we don't hear more politicians at that level say those kinds of things.
I actually think that would work politically.
I do too.
That would actually in this instance, and Kelly Ayotte may have been hurt months ago if she had said that then.
Right.
But now would be looking prescient, and she might be in a better position. Same with with Wisconsin. And I think that I think Eric Paulson, that race here in Minnesota may surprise because in that district, Trump's numbers are down, and there's a solid Democrat running, and so I think that could be one of the examples.
What's your take on that district?
One of the things that this is going to do when you have such turmoil at the top of the ticket, it tests the grassroots connection that each candidate has to their electorate. Right. Have you done a good job? Have you talked to your voters? Have you been out there meeting with people? If you have, you have a way to get through this because you still have, to your point, John, there's integrity there. They know who you are. They know what you're doing. But if you're not talking to them on a regular basis, if you don't have a real good connection to the people in your district, the people who you're supposed to be representing, this is a really tough time to start making an introduction to people or reconnect to people with this conversation going on. That race will be interesting, but Eric Paulson is a good candidate who's got good connections to the community. He's not someone who disappears. He's not, he's not someone who is a polarizing person. It's definitely a much more tighter race because of what Trump brings to the district. But he's a candidate who does do stuff in the community. He doesn't disappear. It does make it more interesting.
Does he have to worry about just people who, where we're at 2 weeks out on this presidential election and the numbers look lopsided? I'm not saying that is how it's going to be, but the potential of that. And dispirited Republicans, in that district sitting it out.
He has to worry about that. And I think he has to worry about that he's running against someone, Terry Bonoff, who also has deep grassroots. People know her in the district. She's a woman, where I think the gender breakdown in voting this year is going to be interesting. It already sways Democratic in the suburbs.
Yep.
That's why I think that race in particular.
And by the way,
Trump's
turning off a lot of Republican women. So they would be. What did you want to say?
Well, Eric Paulson is a careful politician.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's likely to be reelected. He's doing, as Mike says, the right things, meeting with the constituents and not polarizing them. His opponent, Terry Bonoff, is not necessarily a careful politician. She has been very outspoken and a real leader in the Senate, Minnesota Senate. So I like the juxtaposition there, and I think she has a shot.
It's interesting because I think as a progressive Democrat, Terry's a friend, but the things that she's been most outspoken on is things that she's actually to the right of most progressive Democrats. but I think that fits that district well in many ways. And so, I always think about Terry often She always tells me the truth. I often don't like what that truth is, but I hear it from her.
I rest my case.
But in the 8th congressional district, it's a different situation because for a while, I mean, some of the earlier polling showed Trump doing well in northern Minnesota related to trade issues, which makes the Nolan Mills race more interesting. You're seeing letters to the editor and other things in northern Minnesota saying, if you want to save mining in Minnesota, you know, vote for Stuart Mills and vote for Donald Trump. It creates a different dynamic in greater Minnesota, which shows you the broader range of ideology across Minnesota. In the suburbs, it's a different conversation than it may be in northern Minnesota or in, you know, in southern Minnesota. It just adds to the complexity of everything.
I want to talk to you guys about the debates, and we're going to have a debate roundtable, I think, on the eve. The first one is September 26, I think, on a Monday. Typically, are debates a game changer, John?
Not so much.
And is that because the perception of the candidates is pretty much locked in by the time that we get to the debates?
You know, I don't know. I think debates are great because you see the politicians under tremendous pressure.
Right.
And it's not so much what they say, it's how they say it and how they present themselves with confidence. Of course, you can go way out and say the wrong thing or do some kind of gaffe that is going to cause you trouble. But it's really about the perception that you give as a person in person under tremendous pressure in front of how many million, 50 million people watching.
Most of whom have already kind of figured out what they think of the candidates, haven't they?
Exactly. And they're going to be careful.
Yeah, but if you think back to the last election, President Obama's reelection, the second debate where he did so poorly, and his numbers tanked after
that. Yes, that's right.
And there was, you know, he really had to, and then it was the next debate that brought him back up, where he just looked like Obama again. I think this will be interesting because I think they'll both come in, each candidate will come in with very different challenges. I think everyone's going to be looking to see how Hillary Clinton deals with Trump just saying crazy things.
Personality-wise and tone-wise.
While at the same time, though, Trump may be feeling at that point a lot of pressure from Republicans to say, like, you better look presidential.
Right.
And so then if he's not looking like himself, then the bar is actually not that high for Hillary in that instance, I think.
Because it comes down to knowledge of, I mean, how are you going to sound?
Yeah, he doesn't like policy.
Well, and there's a different way. I mean, this gets back to the kind of like the reality show component of what's been in the Republican campaign. I mean, those first debates during the Republican primary season, I mean, CNN got huge numbers that first debate. And all of a sudden, the debates changed. You know, you saw how CNN, Fox, and MSNBC promoted the debates as more of a media event to make money.
Very true.
And you know what? They saw a chance to sell advertising at a higher rate, but it's also going to be, you know, and you hear people in the Republican world saying, well, let's see what happens after the debate. It's like one more milestone. Is there a pivot point somewhere around this road here
well,
where things are going to turn?
What would you say to that?
You know, everyone keeps, you know, keeps waiting for yet another pivot. He just realigned his campaign staff. Is that going to be the thing that gets him to be, you know, something different? And yet you hear him say, I am who I am. It's kind of like the Popeye phrase, you know, I am who I am and that sort of thing. The debates, though, are also the chance where in a world where we get so fractionalized into podcasts and everything else we do away from mainstream main events, this will be an event where everyone watches kind of in a live, real-time thing.
There is a collective kind of experience to
this
that.
This is
that
a
we
live event. You're
often
not going to DVR the event. You're going to be there and you're going to watch. Twitter will explode during that first debate, and let's see what happens. And by the fact that it's so unpredictable, I think it's just going to add more energy into this. And because guess what? Who can predict what Trump will do at that debate?
Well, that's the important thing. And like I say, would it cause a change in direction in the campaign? I doubt it. Does the fact that Trump, the candidate, will go in there and act like Trump, the candidate, like the pathetic individual that he is, that will just confirm to the rest of the country that he is not presidential and he should go away?
Why are you so convinced that he can't withstand the pressure and, you know, I mean, for one, he's getting some positive reinforcement from these speeches where he's talking policy, he's not off the cuff, he's using the infamous teleprompter. I mean, maybe he's learning that, hey, there's something to this.
Well, and maybe he is, and I'm not saying that he couldn't. And if that is the case, if he goes in and says, and you know, you have the man-woman dynamic, he's got to be careful how he does handles that.
Body language of that.
But if he goes in, stands up straight, and looks at the people and says, thank you for asking that question. I have a 3-point plan. Boom, boom, boom. And shuts his mouth. Then maybe we have a game changer. But we'll see if that
Javier
happens.
Javier does not buy that could happen.
I think every headline will be and all the talk will be is what happened to Donald Trump. That's not the real
but
guy.
That's not what the voter, his most loyal base voters
there goes
want.
The authenticity. Yeah,
well, good,
that's
right.
what
good
we
point.
Have.
Right.
Good yeah. point. So.
What does the Republican Party do, Mike, if this is the kind of blowout that we all started this conversation saying it could be? Remember they did the autopsy in 2012? And they had this big, and this is who we need to be, and he defies, Trump defies all of that.
But
so
ultimately, though, there's, you know, it's the saying that's said in politics, the world is run by those who show up. Those who have been showing up primarily in a lot of these primaries are people who, you know, there's a lot of frustration in the Republican Party, yep. yet a lot of the people don't show up at caucuses and, you know, have not been actively engaged at a grassroots level. And the question's going to be, when this comes, when whatever happens moves forward, where does the party leadership go to say, let's change the conversation, let's get people involved. And if you really do care about moving us in the right direction and changing the way the Republican Party responds to these issues, we're going to need to show up on a Saturday morning. You're going to need to do some things. You're going to need to get actively involved and get your friends involved, because the only way you're going to make a change is to bring grassroots energy into this. And otherwise, you're going to end up repeating this cycle every 4 to 8 years in a way that's going to be, you know, it's going to be kind of a downward cycle, a downward trend. But the one way to change this is to change who's involved in the conversation. If a small group of people are involved in the conversation and you're not, it's hard to complain when you don't show up.
You have a thought on that?
Yes, I do. I mean, it's interesting, and I'm not saying you're wrong, but just think about this campaign year. If it would have been the case that we didn't have primaries and we had all caucuses, Bernie Sanders would be our candidate, I believe. And go back to 92. Bill Clinton wouldn't have been our candidate. It really, really changes things.
Javier?
I understand what you're saying in terms of process, but I think when you look back to the autopsy, which you mentioned, of the Republican Party, what that focused on was the limited appeal of the Republican Party
yes.
to one demographic
yep.
and the absolute need to – it urged passage of immigration reform. It urged ending the anti-immigrant rhetoric.
Right.
And instead, you have a candidate who's just completely blown all of that up. Meanwhile, the demographics are even more dramatically different than they were in 12 or 8 in terms of like a racially diverse electorate. Every month, tens of thousands of new Latinos become 18 and are eligible to vote. And the Latino community is extremely energized to vote against Donald Trump. And so like that's going to be the real thing to my mind is really looking seriously at the question of race within the Republican Party. And I don't know, like I don't yet see the leaders that are willing to have that conversation.
But on the other hand, also, it's time for the Republican Party to take a look at some of these challenging urban issues that we're dealing with, poverty and education, and they're primarily in places where there's Democratic control of cities and school districts. And it's time for the Republican Party to say, if you're going to stake a claim to doing a better way to educate people and get people out of poverty, this is the place where the Republican Party has an opportunity to grow its base.
The Republican Party owns state legislatures and most of the governor's seats. I mean, if they're all in on that,
but they have urban issues in this country.
They've got plenty of arenas in which to make
there are urban
changes.
Issues. You look at Minneapolis and St. Paul. Our school districts are suffering with low levels of education achievement among communities of color based on a system that's dominated by teachers' unions in both cities. That's not an opportunity for a different idea or a different approach, and it's going to take leadership to go there and say, here's a different idea, and we think your community can be better served with a different approach.
This is another show. We will get back to this, Mike. We'll talk about this again. Thank you all for a really great conversation. Good to have you here.